At the Taos Public Library on January 11th, 2020, humorous author and Las Vegas, New Mexico resident Jim Tare read from Howard Bryant's book, Wildest of the Wild West, True Tales of Frontier Town on the Santa Fe Trail, about Las Vegas, New Mexico during the late 1800s. Jim Tare has produced an audio book on Wildest of the Wild West. Here now is Jim Tare.
I read this book, The Wildest of the Wild West, in the early 90s. I was in my 40s. I can't calculate that exactly, but it made me think ever since, and especially now that I've reread the book to produce this audio book, it made me think about the effect of this legacy of violence in Las Vegas on everyday life in Las Vegas. And I have so many thoughts about that, I probably won't get into it at all, except to say that it's hard to reconcile in a way, because Las Vegas is really one of the friendliest towns you could ever imagine. You might attest to that. And yet there's also this undercurrent of violence. I mean, not necessarily an undercurrent, a lot of crime there in some ways, in some circles. Anyway, I'm going to be reading from the book, kind of at random, kind of in order. Some of these are segments that I have recorded, which are on the website where this book is available, which is hookintohistory.com. And I created that website when I did this book because I have an interest. I'm interested in the phenomenon of when you kind of click into history, because I didn't till very late in life. I was not interested in history when I was in school, high school, college even. I just paid no attention. I wasn't aware. And it wasn't until a guy gave me a book. A neighbor, when I was back living in Las Vegas for a while, a neighbor gave me a book for some reason, evidently because he just read it and thought it was interesting. It was a biography of Joseph Smith called No Man Knows My Name, as I recall. And I just was suddenly sucked into history all of a sudden through this biography. I had a sense for the first time that there was history before now. People were here before now. So maybe it happens to various people at various times for various reasons, but that's when it happened for me. And reading this book was an extra trip, because not only is it so vivid and so interesting, but of course it was stuff that happened in my hometown, so I can relate to the places and so on, the locations, most of which are still there, you know. But let me start with this. It was written by Howard Bryan, who was a historian at the, who had a column at the Albuquerque Tribune for years. I met him one time because he gave me a little summary of this book, because I quoted him in my intro. It was a video I was doing about Las Vegas, New Mexico as a film location, which it is a very popular film location, as you may know. And so he gave his little elevator speech about this book, and that was basically that Las Vegas is by far the most violent town in the West, much more so than Tombstone and Dodge City and all those towns with more of a reputation, and measurably so in terms of hangings, murders, hangings per month, whatever. And this all came about, to give you the background, there was, of course, crime and some good stories in here that happened before 1879 when the railroad came in. But the railroad did come in about 1879. Las Vegas was on the Santa Fe Trail, so it was kind of a busy town at that point to begin with. But the trade that was taking place on the Santa Fe Trail was immediately displaced by the railroad in 1879 when it came in, and suddenly now this was the big boom town in the south, in the west, in the southwest, whereas Dodge City had been previously the big railroad town. And where there's railroad towns and where there's business, there are a bunch of hooligans. And these guys all came over, a lot of them came over to Las Vegas at that point. Some famous ones like Doc Holliday and so on, who had a dentist office in Las Vegas. He was a dentist as well as an outlaw. And a bunch of characters that you probably haven't heard of prior to now. But here's a poster. Now, this is interesting. I had this, if you go online to look for this poster, you see about 30 versions of it. Mostly not the original, but reprints designed to look like an Old West poster. And I even had one of these on my wall in college. And a lot of you have probably seen it. And it reads like this. Notice to thieves, thugs, fakers, and bunco steerers, among whom are J.J. Harlan, alias Off Wheeler, Sawdust Charlie, William Hedges, Billy the Kid, not the same Billy the Kid, Billy Mullen, Little Jack the Cuter, Pockmarked Kid, and about 20 others. If found within the limits of this city after 10 o'clock p.m. this night, you will be invited to a grand necktie party, the expense of which will be borne by 100 substantial citizens. Las Vegas, March 24th, 1882. And, you know, when I had this up in college, I was looking at it every day. I'm sure it never occurred to me it was from Las Vegas, New Mexico, where I was from. I assumed it was from the other Las Vegas. Well, I don't think the other Las Vegas really existed, other than just kind of a watering hole, at that point. So I will just read, you know, without any rhyme or reason, I will read some sections from the book, which all of which, of course, are on the audio tape, because the whole book is on the audio tape. I didn't do any selecting. This is in the period. This is like 1865 or so. It's a character who really captivated me from the book. A Judge Benedict. What was his first name? Anyway, Judge Benedict had been a colleague of Abraham Lincoln, had ridden the circuit with Abraham Lincoln way back decades before, and he was appointed to the New Mexico Supreme Court by by Abraham Lincoln in 1853. And he was a tremendous character. I'll just read you two or three stories about him. Well, the main section about him in the book, which introduces him, is his presiding at a trial of a woman named Angel, Paula Angel, who was the first woman to be hanged in the West. He sentenced her to hang for murder, and she had a terrible time. She was hung twice. They didn't do it right. And then the crowd wanted to, I haven't marked this section, I'm just summarizing. Oh, yes, I will read it. So she was hanged one time, but they didn't tie her hands, so she released herself, and the crowd was cheering that she had fulfilled her sentence and she shouldn't be hung again. The crowd rushed in, pushed the sheriff away, and cut the grasping woman down, protesting that she had been hanged and the sentence of the court had been carried out. During the shouting and confusion, Jose de Sena, a prominent Santa Fe citizen, climbed up on the wagon, calmed the crowd, and read to them the warrant of execution, stressing that it stated that the woman was to be hanged by the neck until dead. Before 4 o'clock that day, and she was not dead, and it was not yet 4 o'clock. Once again, Paula Angel was placed in the wagon, this time with her arms bound. The wagon was driven from beneath her, and she paid the supreme penalty, the first woman to be hanged on the western frontier. Now, it goes on with several anecdotes to describe Judge Benedict, what a character he was and kind of what a drunk he was. During the Civil War, some prominent Santa Fe citizens wrote to President Lincoln urging him to remove Benedict as Chief Justice of the New Mexico Supreme Court and replace him with a, quote, good, sober man. They complained that the judge frequented saloons and gambling halls and was often seen drunk and reeling about around the streets. President Lincoln's reply was short and to the point. Well, gentlemen, I know Benedict. We have been friends for over 30 years. He may imbibe to excess, but Benedict drunk knows more law than all the others on the bench in New Mexico know sober. I shall not disturb him. And then here's a long section, but it is a trip, and it takes place right here in Taos, by the way. Taos was evidently on Judge Benedict's circuit. Why can't I remember his first name? Judge Benedict. I'll remember it at some point here. Judge Benedict is best remembered for the wording of a death sentence. And this is another thing I think I heard around somewhere before I ever read this book. This is evidently got some legs also, this story. Judge Benedict is best remembered for the wording of a death sentence he pronounced upon Jesus Maria Martinez during a court session at Taos in April 1864. A Taos jury convicted Martinez of murder in the death of Julian Trujillo, a blacksmith, a murder described by the New Mexican in Santa Fe as revengeful, vindictive, and wanton. This, according to one of the lawyers who was present, is how Benedict sentenced the young man. Jesus Maria Martinez, stand up. Jesus Maria Martinez, you have been indicted, tried, and convicted by a jury of your countrymen of the crime of murder, and the court is about to pass upon you the dread sentence of the law. As a usual thing, Jesus Maria Martinez, it is a painful duty for the judge of a court to pronounce upon a human being the sentence of death. There is something horrible about it, and the mind of the court naturally revolts from the performance of such a duty. Happily, however, your case is relieved of all such unpleasant features, and the court takes positive delight in sentencing you to death. You are a young man, Jesus Maria Martinez, apparently of good physical condition and robust health. Ordinarily, you might have looked forward to many years of life, and the court has no doubt you have, and have expected to die at a ripe old age. But you are about to be cut off in consequence of your own act. Jesus Maria Martinez, it is now springtime. In a little while, the grass will be springing up green in these beautiful valleys. You can see where this is going. And on these broad mesas and mountainsides, flowers will be blooming, birds will be singing their sweet carols, and nature will be putting on her most gorgeous and her most attractive robes, and life will be pleasant, and men will want to stay. But none of this for you, Jesus Maria Martinez. The flowers will not bloom for you, Jesus Maria Martinez. The birds will not carol for you, Jesus Maria Martinez. When these things come to gladden the senses of men, you will be occupying a space about 6x2 beneath the sod. And the green grass and those beautiful flowers will be growing over your lowly head. The sentence of the court is that you be taken from this place to the county jail, and that you be kept there safely and securely confined in the custody of the sheriff until the day appointed for your execution. And then they go through a lot of technicalities with the clerk of the court, the sheriff, when is this going to be carried out, etc. And that you there will be hanged by the neck until you are dead. And the court was about to add, Jesus Maria Martinez, may God have mercy on your soul. But the court will not assume the responsibility of asking an all-wise providence to do that which a jury of your peers has refused to do. The Lord will not have mercy on your soul. However, if you affect any religious belief or are connected with any religious organization, it might be well for you to send for your priest or your minister and get from him such consolation as you can. But the court advises you to place no reliance upon anything of that kind. Mr. Sheriff, remove the prisoner. In spite of the popular belief that the condemned man escaped, he was hanged on schedule. Well,
Kirby is the name you're trying to remember.
Herbie?
Kirby.
Kirby, correct. Thank you. Kirby Benedict. Did you look that up on your phone just now, or did you know it? Oh, wow. Amazing.
You're listening to Jim Thayer on his audio book, Wildest of the Wild West.
Okay, so hangings. There are tons of hangings in this book. It was about the same time as some other hangings, according to Miguel A. Otero. Now we're going to a whole nother chapter, a whole nother story, one of many hanging stories related in here. It was about the same time, according to Miguel A. Otero in his book, My Life on the Frontier, that the hanging windmill claimed yet another victim. Otero, a Las Vegas pioneer who served as governor of New Mexico from 1897 to 1906, identified this victim as a cowboy visitor named Beckworth, who enjoyed demonstrating his skills at handling a pistol. While twirling his pistol in his hand before an admiring audience, the gun went off and killed a man standing behind him. Beckworth apologized, saying it was just an accident. He resumed his pistol twirling, and the gun went off again, this time killing a woman standing in the doorway of her house across the street. Again, Beckworth apologized, saying it was just an accident. Officers quickly arrived on the scene and hauled Beckworth off to jail. He was found hanging from the windmill the next morning, Otero said, with a placard hanging from his neck, which read, "This is no accident." It's such dark, you know, it's such dark humor. I'm sure it wasn't funny at the time, but it's just, you know, this guy has a beautiful way of writing, Howard Bryan. That's one of the great delights of the book, is the way it's written, as you can see. And then he quotes a lot of newspaper reports in here, which are also just beautiful and quirkily written, you might say. Let's see. Oh, here we go. By the way, I didn't tell the story of how this came about. It just occurred to me for some reason or other in the past year to ask the publisher of the book, whom I know, Harmon Houghton of Clear Light Publishers in Santa Fe, whether anybody had ever done an audiobook version of this book and whether I could. And he said, no, and yes, you can. So we arrived, at some terms, and a few months of recording later, which was kind of a chore because I'm halting in my reading. So it took a lot, as you can see, of effort to edit it. Now we have the audiobook over there if you want one today, and at the website, hookintohistory.com. And I meant to say about that website, I named it that because I'm hoping that this book, for people or for young people or whoever, because of the vividness of it and because of the fact that it's local, will be the kind of thing that can hook people into history if they are not already. A lot of people are. Okay, so the posse from Las Vegas is chasing down some guys who are involved in a gunfight in Las Vegas. In Mora, I believe. The posse reached and took up positions around the farmhouse at about 10 a.m. on February 6th and called upon the fugitives to surrender. Henry, whom the Optic is our local paper in Las Vegas, okay? Still is. Henry, whom the Optic said would rather fight than eat, refused to surrender and prepared to defend himself. His companion, Dorsey, persuaded him to give up without a fight, however, and the two agreed to surrender on condition that they would be protected from any mob violence in Las Vegas. The posse, with its two prisoners in a wagon, reached Las Vegas that afternoon, and the two were subsequently placed in jail with their wounded companion, West. Henry and Dorsey had been reluctant to talk about the dance hall shootings with their captors during the ride to Las Vegas. The Optic reported on February 7th that Henry had made the only reference to the, quote, fatal fuss and attributed the whole difficulty to whiskey, adding, this is the optic adding now, however, in speaking of this lamentable affair, his demeanor all the time was unruffled and nonchalant, as if he were the guest of a party instead of a man under arrest for a foul, cowardly murder for which he may be jerked to Jesus before the sun rises again. Continuing a little bit down the page here, the optic's prediction on February 7th that Henry would be jerked to Jesus before the sun rises again proved to be accurate. That night, about 100 Las Vegas citizens gathered silently in the streets and marched to the jail. They battered down the floor, demanded and received the keys to the cells from the jailer, opened cell doors, and led Henry and Dorsey out with ropes around their necks. The wounded West was carried from his cell. Leading and carrying the prisoners through the dark streets to the West Las Vegas Plaza, the mob halted at the windmill in the center of the plaza, the hanging windmill, and dragged the three up to the windmill platform, the ropes still around their necks. The nooses were adjusted, and the other ends of the ropes looped up over beams in the windmill superstructure. The three were asked if they had anything to say before being hanged. Tom Henry replied that his true name was Thomas Jefferson House and requested that somebody write to his parents, Mr. and Mrs. U.B. House, in Pueblo, Colorado. "Boys, it's pretty rough to be hung, but I wish someone would write to my father and mother," he said. "I will stand the consequences and die like a man." James West said only that his real name was James Lowe, although it was determined later that it was Anthony Lowe from Kansas. James Dorsey would say nothing of his background, declaring that he had not a friend or a relative in the world. West, suffering from his wounds and shivering in the cold, what was the date? Oh, February 7th, yeah. West, suffering from his wounds and shivering in the cold, was selected to be the first to pay the penalty. When he began to whimper, Henry turned to him and said, "Jim, be still and die like a man." "Boys, you are hanging a mighty good man," West said, regaining his composure. His last words before he was swung into the air were, "Please button up my pants." At that moment, according to some reports, Joe Carson's widow, now Joe Carson was, I think, the sheriff who was shot by these guys in some big shootout. Joe Carson's widow, who was in the crowd, picked up a rifle and began shooting at the three victims. General gunfire then erupted as the mob followed her lead. Tom Henry, falling to his knees in the ensuing hail of bullets, crawled to the edge of the windmill platform, pleading, "Boys, for God's sake, shoot me again, shoot me in the head." In a moment, all three were dead in pools of blood on the windmill platform. Each man later was placed in a coffin, and the three were buried in a single grave. Now, here's a segment that was really kind of odd, and I didn't think of it to include in my reading here or in the snippets that are on the website till a guy in Santa Fe who interviewed me for a story and who went through the book in the library said, "Boy, that was an odd episode," and I thought about it. And it was, and this story reminds me of, I didn't mark any specific part of it. I might read the whole thing. Again, it's so beautifully written. But you know what I picture during this episode is W.C. Fields. See if this reminds you of W.C. I'll read the whole chapter. It's very short. Death of a Salesman, it's called. James Moorhead, a traveling salesman for several St. Louis wholesale houses, arrived in Las Vegas during the last week in February 1880 and checked in at the St. Nicholas Hotel in the New Town. Las Vegas has an old town and a new town. The new town popped up when they built the railroad, and that's why we have and railroad employees, and that's why we have a kind of Midwestern-looking new town there, in addition to the more adobe-style old town. Anyway, at the St. Nicholas Hotel in the new town. Moorhead, a 40-year-old bachelor, was a neatly dressed man who enjoyed the finer things of life. He expected and demanded the best of service wherever he stopped, whether it was a refined eastern city or a rough frontier town like Las Vegas. In Las Vegas, the traveling salesman had the nerve to keep arriving at the hotel dining room late for his meals and insisting that he be served fried eggs. What happened to him as a result was brought out in the coroner's inquest a few days later. Moorhead first appeared late for supper in the St. Nicholas dining room on a Friday night. He asked the waiter, 23-year-old James Allen, if he could have fried eggs for his supper. The waiter, who had operated a saloon in Leadville, Colorado before drifting off to Las Vegas, said he would ask the cook. Returning moments later, Allen told the salesman that the cook was too busy to fry any eggs and that he would have to take his supper without them. Saturday morning, Moorhead arrived in the dining room late for breakfast and asked again for fried eggs. Allen told him that he was too late for eggs, that the cook was already preparing dinner and didn't have time to bother with them. Moorhead was late for breakfast again Sunday morning, but managed to get his eggs. Asking for eggs again that evening. It's funny when I think about it, this egg thing.
You're listening to Jim Thayer, author of the audio book Wildest of the Wild West, recorded on January 11th, 2020 at Taos Public Library in Taos, New Mexico. This is KCEI 90.1 FM, Red River, Taos.
Asking for eggs again that evening at supper, Moorhead was told that he could have eggs after the rush was over, but when the rush had subsided, he told Allen he had lost his appetite and did not want any eggs. Tuesday morning, March 2nd, Moorhead once again was late for breakfast. He was in good spirits, as the day before he had sold a stock of liquor to the Charles Ilfeld Company, which, by the way, Charles Ilfeld came from Taos to start his business in Las Vegas, as you may know. He asked the waiter if he could have eggs for breakfast, and Allen, losing patience, told the salesman he could always have eggs if he would just come for his meals at the proper time. The salesman was not ready to let the matter drop, however. Words followed, and Allen told Moorhead that he didn't care to hear any more about the subject. If he were dissatisfied, he should complain to the proprietor. "You needn't get up on your left ear about it," Moorhead exclaimed. "Your constant racket about eggs is enough to put anybody on his ear," Allen retorted. "Please go to hell," the salesman said. "I don't care to," the waiter answered, "but you can go as quick as you want to." I don't know how they got this verbatim transcript of this, but okay. Moorhead stood up from the table and rolled up his sleeves. "If you want anything out of me, you can get it," he said. The two men went into a clinch. Moorhead managed to pick Allen up and carry the struggling waiter partway across the dining room. In the scuffling, he fell over some chairs, falling to the floor with the waiter beneath him. Others in the dining room managed to separate the two men. Allen immediately ran behind the bar, picked up a beer bottle, and started for Moorhead again. He dropped the bottle when he saw Moorhead put his hand behind him as if reaching for a weapon. The waiter ran into the kitchen, borrowed a revolver from a dishwasher, and returned to the dining room, gun in hand. He demanded that Moorhead apologize. Moorhead, stooping slightly, advanced slowly toward the waiter, who retreated slowly into the kitchen. When Moorhead reached the kitchen door, Allen pulled the trigger. The salesman slumped to the floor, fatally wounded. Moorhead died at 10 o'clock that night, 12 hours after he was shot. The coroner's jury, after hearing the waiter's testimony, ruled that James Moorhead had come to his death by a pistol shot fired by James Allen, and that the killing was willful, malicious, and felonious murder, and without justification or provocation whatsoever. Allen was taken to the county jail to await trial. Doesn't seem quite right, but okay. Oh, and here's a character. Has anybody ever heard the song "The Dirty Little Howard Who Shot Mr. Howard"? Mr. Howard being Jesse James's alias. Well, Jesse James was in Las Vegas. He was there only briefly as a tourist. But Bob Ford, who shot him, did open a saloon in Las Vegas. And this and apparently he was really obnoxious with bragging about having killed Jesse James. That was his whole shtick. He had traveled around the country with it, and he always thought it would, you know, something to brag about, and the people in Las Vegas, for one, didn't appreciate it, I guess. Citizens of Las Vegas, tired of hearing Ford boast of his killing of Jesse James and of his prowess with a gun, decided that he needed a... Well, by the way, he shot Jesse James in the head from behind in his own house. So this is what a hero he was. Decided that he needed a lesson in humility. The man picked to humiliate him was Jose Chavez y Chavez, an expert marksman who had fought alongside Billy the Kid in the Lincoln County War of 1878. Sheriff Cleofas Romero challenged Ford to engage in a shooting match with Chavez y Chavez, each of them to fire at a small target. Reluctantly, Ford agreed to the match. Followed by the sheriff and a large group of citizens, Ford and Chavez y Chavez proceeded to an open space at the outskirts of town. Sheriff Romero stood a small coin on end on a fence post and invited Ford to shoot at it. Ford fired, missing the target by a wide margin. Chavez y Chavez then stepped forward, fired quickly, and hit the coin in the center. When Ford protested that the match was unfair, Chavez y Chavez challenged him to a duel, suggesting that they stand back to back, walk 20 paces at a given signal, then turn and fire at one another. Ford refused the challenge. Thoroughly humiliated, he packed his bags and left town. There's another story in here I'll get to that had a similar outcome. here's a story I liked. This is about the, relates to the story of the Gorras Blancas, the white caps. Anybody ever heard of them? Yeah. It was a kind of a populist native uprising group that was against land grabbing and crooked lawyers and all that. You know, they were buying up the common lands in Las Vegas. And one member of this group who was elected to the House of Representatives in the New Mexico Territorial Legislature on the Partido ticket was Pablo Herrera, who had served time in prison for killing a man during an argument at Tecolote near his home. After sitting quietly through sessions of the Territorial Assembly in Santa Fe, Herrera decided that he had had enough. At the close of the legislative session, he rose from his seat and delivered this brief address to his colleagues. Gentlemen, I have served several years in the penitentiary, but only 60 days in the legislature, the present House of Representatives. I have watched the proceedings here carefully. I would like to say that the time I spent in the penitentiary was more enjoyable than the time I spent here. There is more honesty in the halls of the territorial prison than in the halls of the legislature. I would prefer another term in prison than another election to the House. Thus ended Pablo Herrera's brief political career. I'll just read one or two more. Well, there's a long chapter in here. You know, I had heard, living in Las Vegas, I hadn't heard most of these stories, but I had heard about an outlaw gang named Vicente Silva and his 40 thieves. Well, according to this book, Vicente Silva was a guy, not a big guy, but apparently a very bad guy. And he had a saloon, and he had a big gang of guys who were doing all kinds of stuff, cattle rustling and everything else. But apparently, because of all these other goings on, and because that was, you know, happening more among the Anglo population, and that was more reported in the paper, apparently the official Las Vegas, you know, the sheriff's department and the newspaper and all that, were much more aware of that gang of criminals than this one. So it wasn't till that kind of broke up that more Anglo gang of criminals was kind of fell apart and run out of town that there was more awareness of the Silva gang. And he was kind of put on the run, Silva was, because somebody whose cattle he had rustled confronted him on it and reported it. So he's kind of on the run now, and he's hiding out of town. And he doesn't have much resources, and he calls for his wife to come meet him. And he attracts her by the fact that he has kidnapped their daughter. Well, she doesn't know. The daughter has been taken and put into school. I think it may have been in Taos, as a matter of fact. But she's just worried crazy about where is the daughter. And he gets her to come meet him outside of town on the promise of seeing her daughter. So Avila picked her up. Avila is one of his henchmen. Picked her up that evening and drove her northeast out of Las Vegas. Silva met them along the way and accompanied them to Los Alamos, which is not that Los Alamos, but a little town near Vegas called Los Alamos, where he ushered his wife into a house. Angrily, he asked her for money, and she gave him all she had, $200. Then he asked for her jewelry, and when she began to protest, he drew a knife and stabbed her to death. Summoning the five gang members who had been waiting outside, Silva asked them to help wrap his wife's body in a blanket and carry it to a suitable burying place. In the darkness, they carried it to a deep arroyo south of the village, threw it to the bottom, and kicked the sandy banks down over it. Silva's companions were shocked that their leader would kill his wife for her money. He handed each of them $10, and as he did so, they could not help but notice the bulging money belt he wore around his waist. They had just started walking back to the village when Antonio Jose Valdez walked up next to Silva, placed the barrel of his .45 revolver close to Silva's left temple, and pulled the trigger. Silva fell dead to the ground. They divided Silva's money and jewelry among themselves, dragged his body back to the arroyo, threw it in, kicked the banks down over it, and went their separate ways. It was nearly 2 years before it became generally known that Silva was dead. In the intervening period, however, the violence he had spawned lived on. Well, does that give you the flavor? I'd be glad to take questions, and I'll remember to repeat them. And by the way, this is the first book I have ever recorded as an audiobook. I've done acting and I've done voiceovers for other smaller things, but never a book project. It's quite a, should I say, an experience or an ordeal. But anyway, any questions? Yes.
I'm wondering if your interest in history includes finding where some of these original saloons were, the actual locations, say of Silva or Ford, if those records exist.
Asking whether my interest in history leads me to look around and see where some of these locations like Silva's Saloon and so on are. Well, I think I know where Silva's Saloon was. I think it was pointed out to me long ago at an age where I could, you know, absorb and remember information. But a lot of the locations are still there. Of course, the train depot, the Plaza Hotel, the Plaza Park where the windmill was, and so on. I look around with a different eye towards these things now, you might say, relating what's there to what I've read. Yeah, a lot of location. Las Vegas is a very beautiful town and an old town. Even the new town has got a lot of these buildings and locations that are mentioned in this book. So I do kind of look at it with that in mind. Yes?
Is there a Las Vegas map of these historical sites?
Is there a Las Vegas map of these historical sites? Yeah, there's a beautiful map. I have one. Somebody did one of those beautiful engraved maps of the town in, I think, 1881. Which was kind of when it was really getting rolling. And some of the locations I think are named. Honestly, I haven't looked at it since I've reread this book. I should look at it more carefully and see if I can relate to some of the locations mentioned in this book. But yeah, I guess we're lucky. I don't know if every town had a beautiful, detailed engraved map like that done, and for what reason, but there is one from that period, at least one from that period. Yes?
Could you speak a little bit about the technical aspects of doing a recording?
Oh boy, can I speak of the technical aspects of doing the recording? Yeah, I can. I did it all wrong. I picked a quiet location. That's one thing I did. I arranged for a very sound dampened room, my bedroom, and set up a mic and tried to keep a consistent distance from it. And I plugged the mic into the computer, laptop, which I find out is not the thing to do. You're supposed to have something called a preamp, which allows you to control the sound a little better. And then it turned out, after all this recording, I didn't really check it as I went along, it turned out that this mic I used was not a great mic to begin with, which is a mistake if you're going to invest that much time in recording a book. And it would fluctuate, like at the start of sentences, not because it had something called limiting set, but just seemed to do it on its own. So that was one of the many things that by the way, the recording came out fine, if I do say so myself. We applied some EQ, some sound contouring, which an engineer friend of mine in LA worked out to compensate for the mic. But that was one of the things that caused the editing to take even a lot longer than reading the book. So it was quite a knockdown, drag out affair. And but you weren't asking about my troubles. You were asking about how it's done. Well, I recorded it into a program called SoundForge, Sony SoundForge, and it makes it very easy to edit, although there was just too much of it. But it allowed me to do that. Then I had to figure out, it had been a long time since I had ever gotten CDs commercially duplicated. I had to figure out how to do that and how much of it to do for myself. And I didn't like the price that they charged. I mean, I couldn't charge as little as $24.95 for this if I had done it by getting them completely duplicated professionally with the covers and everything else. I put it together kind of piece by piece. I ordered the boxes. Got the covers printed. I put all that together, put them together. That's the way I did it. Of course, I do everything the hard way. But you asked. But if it weren't for that, you couldn't even do this is a 5-CD set, which goes for 5.5 hours. That's 5.5 hours, hours of driving pleasure for you, commuting pleasure. But you couldn't do it even for that little I didn't figure I could do it for that little if I paid the price that the professional duplicators wanted. Now, I haven't yet put it online. That's the next step. You can sell downloads of it, which a lot of people do. But a lot of people drive with CDs now. Still. Yes?
One of our favorite Netflix series is Longmire.
Oh, yeah.
And Longmire was filmed a lot in Las Vegas, particularly in the Plaza area.
Yeah.
Do you know anything about that production being down there?
Well, the question is about Longmire, which was shot in Las Vegas. I don't know too much. You know, I had never seen it. I'm a terrible person. I had never seen it until about 2 weeks ago. I watched it on Netflix. Yeah, I kind of liked the one episode I saw. And, of course, I was very aware that it was being shot in Las Vegas. I was an extra in it one time. I was never called to audition for it as an actor. I was an extra in it one day. What do I know about it? I don't know. You know, the doorway leads up to the office where they actually shot the office scenes. And that's still there. It's beautiful. They have the decal on the window. It says sheriff's office. It's right next to the Plaza Hotel, which gets a lot of tourists, a lot of traffic. And so that's what I know. A lot of tourists like to go stand by there and take their pictures. And I never heard anything but good about this, the crew and the people from the film. I never saw them around. I don't think I would have recognized them if I had.
We strongly recommend anybody that has Netflix see Longmire. We watched the whole series twice.
Wow.
That's how much we liked it in Las Vegas.
To repeat that, you very much recommend the series, especially if you have Netflix and can see it, and you've seen it twice, the whole series. It was good. I've seen a lot worse things. You know, I meant to say, I appreciated that the writer of this article that was in the Taos News mentioned, how did she say it? The history of Las Vegas, as gleaned from the book, is filled with enough fascinating imagery and descriptions of frontier life to fill dozens of screenplays. And I agree with that. I had that thought as I was rereading the book. In fact, my agreement with the publisher anticipates that possibility that somebody might buy the screen rights to some of the stories in this book. And I myself am producing or getting ready to produce a series about, not about any specific stories in the book, but about a guy very much like myself who is a radio host who is also reading and recording the audiobook version of this book. It's called The Wildest, and the tagline is, "History has a way of dropping in." And if I may read the synopsis in two sentences, three sentences. A talk radio host who is also a voiceover artist is recording a book for CD, Wildest of the Wild West, also broadcast on his radio show. As he records certain stories and is concerned about some of them, hanging stories, etc., he starts encountering scenes which seem to be spilling over from the book, from history, into his real life, such as almost accidentally hanging himself, encounters with dubious characters and criminals, etc. The audience can see this connection even before he does. So that's something I'm working on as part of this whole experience. Any other questions? Yes.
I kind of have a two-part question. One, Longmire was filmed there. Of course, Billy Jack was filmed in the martial arts scene where he fights the townspeople. Right?
Oh, yeah.
The park there as well. Your opinion on why Las Vegas is a location that they like to shoot movies and TV series?
Yeah.
And number two, Billy the Kid, what's your opinion on...
Well, two-part question. One is about what explains the tremendous amount of film history in film shooting in Las Vegas. And Billy Jack, I hadn't even remembered. That doesn't even come up as the top 10 on a lot of the lists. Las Vegas has been number one, it had a period around 1915 where at the peak of the silent films, it was big for silent films. Tom Mix, if you remember Tom Mix, he had a whole film company there, as did Romaine Fielding, who was another silent film star. So I don't know why it has been such a film capital for so many films. I mean, the list is endless. No Country for Old Men was shot there, largely. I can't even get into it. I can't remember all the films that have been shot there. A lot that you've heard of. But for one thing, it has that Midwestern look that's available. If somebody wants to shoot a film in the West, in Santa Fe, in New Mexico, outside of Hollywood and the costs involved with Hollywood, you can get any look, as a commercial director said to me in the video that I did. He said you can get any look from Midwestern to country to mountains, plains, or on the mountains, or on the plains, or right between them. Red Dawn was shot entirely there, by the way. So that's a good portrait of the town. I don't know. I don't know. I don't know why. It's not because we have a real aggressive film commission in Las Vegas, as far as I know. It's just got the look, I guess. And, you know, I'll tell you something funny. I've always said people are so nonchalant about movies there because there are so many. Sometimes there's two movies shooting at once. Oh, Roswell, the TV series shot there. Longmire. The one that's out now called Our Lady of, Our Perpetual Lady Limited, something like that. People are so nonchalant about movies, I think they have trouble sometimes getting extras. You know, being an extra in a movie is so exciting, right? But I think they have trouble finding people to do it sometimes. What was your other question?
About Billy the Kid.
Oh, Billy the Kid. Yeah, Billy the Kid makes a few appearances here in this book. He was in the Las Vegas jail once or twice. And, you know, he comes across as a real funny, personable kind of character. I can't dig here to find this passage, but he always seemed to have a sense of humor. He was in the jail and a reporter got to him. This is when he was very famous. A reporter got to him and asked him what he felt about the predicament he was in because he was, you know, about to be taken on a train to Santa Fe and, to a more secure location, because people were always escaping from the Las Vegas jail. In fact, he did at one point. So he said something like, well, a guy's got to be upbeat. You can't always be worried about everything. What kind of life would that be? You know, some kind of upbeat answer like that. And as he was in the train with some of these other guys who were being transferred from Las Vegas to Santa Fe, there was a huge crowd because they were trying to get at one guy they wanted to lynch, not Billy the Kid, but somebody else. But he was a celebrity, and the kids were doing bang-bang like this at him, and he was doing bang-bang out the window with the kids, you know. I don't know. And then there's a story in here. I'm just not going to leaf through and find it. But when he was finally executed, he was shot by Pat Garrett, his body was put on display. They had a big, you know, concession going for people to come look at his body. His trigger finger was in a jar that was on display for people to see, a separate event. So I don't know. Does that answer your questions?
Sure.
Okay. Again, if I may plug it one more time for people out there listening, you can see more about the book, see interviews about it, news stories, buy the book if you like at www.hookintohistory.com. Okay, well, I have some over here of the audiobook, and I'll be glad to sign anybody who wants it. Thank you.
You have been listening to Jim Thayer, author of the audiobook Wildest of the Wild West, recorded on January 11, 2020 at Taos Public Library in Taos, New Mexico. This is KCEI 90.1 FM, Red River, Taos.